Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on groundwater depletion when we come back. You know, in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." That clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Now, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper. Things like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, debt, usury. Well, back in 1965, Congress said that there is no difference in the value of the gold and silver coins and the clad coins and currency. And that was codified in Title 31 of the U.S. Code. And it's true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of gold over paper. And there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes due on the paper over the gold. Now, God and our founding fathers didn't give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. They knew, and they knew full well back in 1933 when they did it, that in order to subjugate a free people, they would first have to take away the people's gold and silver coin, to take away the people's right to property, and destroy those property rights under the first plank to the Communist Manifesto. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and property rights. And that's because property is the legal foundation for all of our liberties. So let me teach you how to do just that. That's in our business school, which is now on compact disc for adult homeschool. Now, if you'd like more information about private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? Remember, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Now, it's informative, it's entertaining. It's educational. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Remember, our business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, why don't you go to the website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email, and then send an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Alright, now we've been talking about this thing of the depletion of groundwater. The water wells are going dry, not just here in the United States, but around the world. And I contend that that ties more directly to Revelation chapter 6 probably than any other single event that I have heard of in my brief 67-year lifetime. It spells disaster on a scale that can only be described in the Bible. It's of biblical proportions. So I got to looking at this problem and I said to myself, is there a solution? So last time I said this program, the concluding segment here, we would take a look at the solutions. But before I get into those solutions, of which there are some good solutions here, I got a letter from a fellow by the name of Jim, and he sent a letter that takes longer for me to write an answer to than it does to take 5 or 10 minutes and explain it. I did a series of programs here on evolution some time back, and I got a ton of mail that told me that I had my head up the wrong end of my anatomy over here, so I thought, well, I'll answer a couple of them. Yesterday I answered one here from Charles. in which I pointed out that there's a lot of assumptions, sounds likes, and they's, and they disproved it, and rumor has it, and allegedly, and I can't remember what, and I pointed out that that's not exactly science. And also pointed out that it's not my burden in life to try to convince everybody out there that I'm right and you're wrong. I'm a reporter, and as a reporter, I present facts and information. And it's up to you to take the facts and information and run with the ball. You don't offend me by what you believe. And so when you write me a letter and you say, well, let me point this out. I appreciate the letter. I don't want you to think now that I'm belittling you. If you're sincere and you want to know the answer, so do I. I think education's a lot of fun. I'm still learning. You know, I'm an old man, but I'm still learning. Every day I learn something new. And I've been around doing this for 50 years or more, and I assume if I live another 30 years, I will be smarter 30 years from now than I am today. But the letter goes like this. It says, a few months ago, I became aware of your radio programs on the Internet, and I was hooked because I moved from my former residence and was unable to access the Internet for a few weeks. I'm only now listening to your flood series. Now, where in the Bible does the Bible state that the earth is 6,000 years old? Well, Jim, to my knowledge, there's no place in the Bible that says that the earth is 6,000 years old. And if it does say that, I missed it. I have no idea. But then that doesn't mean that the answer that the world is 6,000 years old isn't contained in the Bible. And then you go on to say, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth became null and void. And then in parenthesis it says chaotic. How do you know that the number of years passed by from the time God created the earth and when it became chaotic? I haven't got a clue, Jim. Not a clue. I wasn't there. I'm not a witness. And I don't have any evidence. I don't have any names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, or evidence at all. None. Zero. In fact, I'm a recent arrival here on planet Earth. I just got here in 1939. So the answer to that is, I don't know. Next, you ask, we know from other scriptures that Satan was placed on Earth, and we know after some time that Satan rebelled. But how long after? I don't know. I wasn't there. I'm not an eyewitness. I never claimed to be a witness. I never claimed to be an eyewitness. And I never claimed that I knew of anybody else that was an eyewitness. I gave you a report from the Bible that claimed that there was an eyewitness. We'll get into that in a second. But of my own knowledge, Jim, I don't know. You go on to say it could have been millions or billions of years. Time has no meaning to spirit beings. All right? Yeah, you're right, Jim. It could have been millions and millions or billions and billions of years. Again, I don't know. I wasn't there. I can't tell you that. Time has no meaning to spirit beings. I don't know that. I have no idea of what time means to spirit beings. I don't know of any place in the Bible where it says time has no meaning to spirit beings. And again, I don't have any knowledge. I've never had a spirit being come to me and tell me, time has great meaning to me, George. Or time has absolutely no meaning to me. Now maybe you know something that I don't know. And I wouldn't dispute that. I believe you ought to contemplate very carefully the first verse of the scriptures. Yours truly, Jim. So I did, Jim. You told me, go to the first scripture, the first verse of the scriptures, and so I did. And so here's what I read in the first verse of the scripture. Let me flip over here. Be patient with me now. I'm just an old plumber. It says here in the first verse, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. Verse 2 says, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. I've got a note here in verse 2, Jim, where the word was, I put it in brackets. And then I wrote the word became in the margin. Jim, that's called the gap theory. The gap theory. The gap theory was devised about 100 years ago to come up with an explanation for evolution in the Bible. And it was devised by religious people who could not answer the evolutionary arguments of great time periods. And so the religious people said, well, we can't answer evolution, so therefore evolution must be true, so therefore we need to go to the Bible, and we need to find in the Bible some place where it says that God created the heavens and the earth, but he did it over a long period of time. So the evolutionists, and I read National Geographic every month, and I mean the National Geographic magazine, Jim, has now turned into the National Evolutionary Journal. I mean, there's hardly a month goes by that they don't have some big article in there about Neanderthals or about the cosmos or about supernovas or something. And in every article, they talk about millions and billions of years and the Big Bang Theory and so on. And okay. Evolution is philosophy and creation is philosophy. And you're just as entitled to your philosophy as I'm entitled to mine. But I want to bring your attention here to verse 2 of Genesis chapter 1. That word was, and the earth was without form and void. And remember I said I put a bracket around it and put the word became in there. I did that because a theologian told me that that word was incorrect, and that that word was should have been translated became. Well, that's so that the gap theory can be put into the Bible. Now, I have the King James Version, and every place in the King James Version where you see a word that has been inserted by the translators, it's in italics. That word in verse 2 is not in italics. It's in the original. And it means just exactly what it says, as opposed to what you and I were told that it should mean. Now, if you want to believe the theologian who told you that that word is incorrect and here's what it should say, and you want to correct God, get after it. Don't let me get in your way. So I took a look at the story flow here, and I want to point out here, for instance, in verse 12. It says, and the earth brought forth grass and herb yielding seed after his kind, and the tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself after his kind, and God saw that it was good, and the evening and the morning were the third day. That's verse 13. In the evening and the morning were the third day. Verse 19, and the evening and the morning were the fourth day. And he goes through there six times, and it says evening and morning. Are there evenings and mornings in 1,000-year periods? I don't know. I don't see any place in the Bible that talks about the evening and the morning were the third 1,000-year period. Now, that's what people believe, but I don't see that anywhere. So I have to conclude that that's philosophy rather than science, and it isn't an accurate reading of the Scripture. Now, this 1,000-year concept comes from 2 Peter 3, verse 8. Let's read that one. 2 Peter 3, verse 8. Because people have to have 1,000 years as a day, and a day is like 1,000 years. And there is a place in the Bible that actually says that, and it's in 2 Peter 3, 8, and it says, be patient with me here. It says, but beloved, be not ignorant of this one thing, that one day is with the Lord as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is as a day. Well, okay. So? I can make that same statement. You know, as an old man, I can say 10 years is like a day, and a day is like 10 years in my life. I can't speak of 1,000-year periods because I didn't live 1,000 years, Jim, but I lived 10. In fact, I've lived several tens, and I can look back at 1995. God, it was just the other day. I can look back to 1985. That wasn't very long ago. I can remember 1975 when my third daughter was 3 years old. That didn't seem like a long time to me. So I can say to you, you know, 10 years is like a day, and a day is like 10,000 years. But this statement in here, 1,000 years is with God like a day, and a day is like 1,000 years, doesn't tell us that God took 1,000 years to make something. In fact, when you look at Genesis 1 and 2, he says, "In the evening and the morning." Now, I know an evening and a morning when I see it. And that comes in those periods of time between sunrise and sunset. And the Bible is replete with all kinds of terms like days. Jesus said, aren't there 12 hours in a day? I didn't see him say anywhere, isn't there 500 years in a day and 500 years in a night? I don't see any examples of that anywhere in the scripture. So if you take the word was in Genesis 1 verse 2, and you change that word to became without any authority, and then you go over here to 2 Peter 3 verse 8, and you take a statement which says a year is like 1,000, or a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is like a day to God, and then you combine the two with your spin, I guess you could come up with 7,000 years for creation. I did because that's what the theologian told me. And I didn't know any different. And so for years and years, I believed in the gap theory. That was before I took a look at it and said, gee, I wonder if God was telling us the truth. Because you see, the evolution guy comes along and he says, no, it's not 7,000 years, it's 7 billion years. So the theologian comes along and says, no, it wasn't 7 billion years, but it was 7,000 years that God took to create the heavens and the earth. I guess that's because we just can't believe that God could do it in 7 literal days, 1 week. I guess that's just beyond comprehension. But again, I'm just a reporter. I didn't come here to report what I can believe or what I can't believe. I just said, this is what the text says. Here's what the statement is. This guy that wrote the book of Genesis claims to be God, and he claims that he did it, and he claims that he's an eyewitness. I reported to you, Jim, the eyewitness who said that he was there said that it was 7 days, not 7,000 years. So if you don't believe the witness, well, then that's not my problem in life. I'm a reporter. I reported the story accurately. And you don't believe the story that I reported. So I documented my story and I said, here's where the story came from. And you're saying, no, the documentation that you're showing me is incorrect. Okay, you're not going to make me mad. Now, your statement here, Jim, that says time has no meaning to spirit beings is strictly philosophy. How do you know that time has no meaning to spirit beings? Who told you that? Where'd you get that information? Did you get it from a spirit being who came to you and said time has no meaning to us? I don't know. No spirit being ever came to me and said time has meaning or has no meaning. That's what we call in law a conclusion based upon insufficient facts. Bring forth more facts, Jim, before I can change my opinion concerning time has no meaning for spirit beings. You say it could have been millions or billions of years. I don't dispute that. But that's philosophy. When you say God could have taken millions or billions of years between the time that Satan was placed on the earth, and sure, it could have been millions or billions of years, but Jim, it could have been 5 or 6 days too. I mean, hell, the testimony is that we're talking about days, not thousands of years, or millions or billions of years. Millions and billions comes from evolution. Evolutionists don't make any bones about it. They reject the scriptural record. They say it's pure BS, and it's not true. And they're in the majority. And you're with the majority, and I'm in the minority. So if you want to be with the majority, get after it. But I don't think it's true. Now your statement here that says Satan was placed on the earth. And we know after some time that Satan rebelled. But how long after? I don't know that either. The story is found about Satan in, where is it? I think it's Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28, I believe it is. There's two stories in there about Satan. Jesus said that he beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven. Doesn't sound like he was placed here to me. Sounds like he was kicked out of heaven and thrown down to the earth. That's what it sounds like to me. But we know from the scripture that Satan today is called the prince of the power of the air. And that he's on planet Earth, and that he tempted the Messiah when he was here. Remember, he took him up on top of the, or up on the pinnacle of the temple. So evidently he's here, and he's running the government in Washington. I can't believe that any sane, rational person could be running our government in Washington. I can only conclude that Satan has to be behind it. So there's my answer to your questions over here. I see some conclusions drawn upon insufficient facts. I see the gap theory over here, which I've rejected the gap theory, but then millions of people believe in it. I don't think that 1,000 years is a day and a day is 1,000 years, and changing the word was in Genesis 1 verse 2 is very scholarly, and I don't think it's very scientific either. So the question that you ask, how do you know that the earth is 6,000 years old, is answered through chronology. So let me just digress here for a second. I'll tell you how that answer, or how that comes about. And since there's no place in the Bible that says the world is 6,000 years old, nor could there be any place in the Bible that says it's 6,000 years old, because the last chapter of the Bible was written about 2,000 years ago. So when the last chapter of the Bible was written, the world hadn't been here 6,000 years yet. It only been here 4,000 years. So that being the case, the Bible couldn't say that the world is 6,000 years old. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't conclude or deduce or figure out that the world is 6,000 years old based upon Bible chronology. So you start off in Genesis, and you'll find a chronology in here. And it says Adam was 130 years old, and he knew his wife Eve, and they had a child named Cain. And then Cain became so old, and he had some children and so on down the line. And as you follow that genealogy out and add and subtract the numbers that you get there, you'll find that between Adam's creation and Noah's flood is 1,656 years. Write that down, Jim. 1,656 years. See if my numbers come out with yours. You can check my arithmetic. It'll take you a little time to do that, but it's kind of fun. I mean, it's not a real chore. It's just, you know, it's kind of interesting. Now, once the flood is over, after the flood, it says that Shem was 600 years old, and he had some children, and it goes through a genealogy as you're going through the book of Genesis here, and you trace that genealogy down, and pretty soon you'll come down to a guy named Moses, and you'll find that Moses comes on the scene somewhere around 1300 B.C. That's about the time, 1300, 1400. Job lived about 1600 B.C. Abraham lived about 2000 to 1900 B.C., you know, in round numbers. Now, as you get up here to Moses, you can take a look at secular history. And you can take a look at secular history and count it back. That's why I come up with these numbers B.C., because they have a little more meaning to us today than counting from Adam forward. Now, there's a period of time in here that is very, very ambiguous. It's the period of time between Moses and David, about 390 years between Moses and David. It's not impossible, and you can trace it out through the books of Joshua and Judges. And a guy by the name of Ivan Pannon did that, and he wrote a chronology called Pannon's Chronology about 1910. I've got that chronology. Now, a lot of other people have done work along these lines also. A guy by the name of Bishop Usher's chronology, he does the same thing. And if you want to get into chronology, it gets pretty heavy and it gets pretty tedious. And especially when you get into First and Second Chronicles and First and Second Kings, and you're trying to trace out the reignal years and the beginning years of these various reigns of various dynasties of kings through the Israelites and the Judites. I mean, that can get pretty tedious. I've done it. And I'm telling you that you're not going to have a lot of fun doing that one. But I did. And when I got through with it, I came up to the Messiah being born approximately 4 BC. And there's a lot of other people that think that he was born 4 BC. We're in a minority. There's not too many, but, you know, there's quite a few of us. That he wasn't born in 0, he was born in 4 BC, and that he died about 31 rather than 33. And now, it's not too difficult to go from the time of the Messiah through the Roman Empire and through secular history from about 2,000 years ago when the Messiah was here until, you know, the year 2000, and you can come up with about 4,000 years. Now, there's a lot of guys that come along and say, well, Creation Day was on Tuesday, you know, 4004 BC. There are some chronologies out that identify it right down to the day. I'm not sure that I could come down to the day, but I can come down to within a few years. And 6,000 years is the number you're going to come out with. And if you want a copy of that chronology, it's called Pannon's Chronology. Now, that's pretty interesting. He's a pretty good writer, and he's got the numbers in there, and they're pretty coherent. And that 390-year period, I think, is better answered by Pannon's chronology than by Usher's. So that's how I know that 6,000 years have expired. All right. And you can see why I wanted to answer that over the air. First of all, I got a lot of letters along that line, and they kind of excoriate me, and they tell me that I'm not too bright. And I don't deny it. I never told anybody that I was very bright or that I knew everything. But keep in mind that I'm not a scientist, and I'm not here to persuade you. I'm here to deliver information. And let's get back to our information on the aquifers. I just discovered here recently that these aquifers are going dry, which has some pretty important portent for the future. And I said that there's some solutions to this problem of the drying up of the aquifers. So let me give you a couple of three things to think about here as we talk about the Oklahoma and Texas panhandles. I got to doing some arithmetic the other day, and I said, well, if groundwater is our Achilles heel, then surface water must be our salvation. To my knowledge, boys and girls, there's only two places for you and I to get our water from. Two places. And then there's a third place that's being talked of, but I'm not sure that it's very, very practicable. The first place that we get our water is from rain. It rains on the ground, and we get water from the rain. The water comes down off the ground, and it goes into little rivulets, and then it goes into little brooks, and then it goes into little creeks, which then develop into little rivers, and then we have a place, you know, like the Grand Canyon and the Rio Grande River and the Colorado River and the Amazon and the Nile Rivers, and they flow into the oceans. And then people, over time, congregated around those rivers because they could row boats up and down it, and they used it as highways, and they used it to drink, and they used it for fishing, and so people congregated around these rivers, like the Mississippi and the Missouri River. You know, when we settled North America, you know, we didn't just rush right down to Tucson, Arizona. We colonized first up the Mississippi and the Ohio and Missouri rivers. All right, now that makes a lot of sense. And we didn't have any water problems. And then we got further away from the rivers, and we went up the creeks, and they went out to Nevada. And I got an old buddy out there in Nevada, and he has a ranch out there. And I mean, that place is dry. Nevada, that's dry. And he started showing me all the places that have water, and I was amazed at how much water there is in Nevada. There's water every place in Nevada. Well, you got to know where to go look for it. But I mean, this guy's got a creek that runs right through his front yard. Well, backyard. A big creek. which comes from snow melt up in the mountain, and then it runs down into this valley, and he waters his cattle out there. So there's people, once they left the Mississippi River, and then they left the creeks, and then they went out into the rangeland, and they found the snow melt and so on, and they developed ranches and farms and so on. People lived, boys and girls, off of surface water. And that's where most of the water comes from. And Harry Rimmer calculated one time that it's 186,000 cubic miles of water that rains down on the earth every year. So there seems to be plenty of rainwater all over planet Earth. Then somebody woke up and they said, look, we've got the Great Plains out here, and there's a lot of land there, and it doesn't rain enough on there to grow corn. It rains enough on there to grow grass. See, this guy I'm telling you about in Nevada, he's not trying to grow corn out there in Nevada. He's not planting cotton and soybeans out there, because he knows he doesn't have anywhere near enough water for that. But now, a lot of ranchers, a lot of farmers, a lot of people moved out into Nebraska, in Kansas, in Colorado, and the ground was dry. It only rains about 17 inches a year there, and they couldn't grow corn and wheat and crops, but they tried it anyway. And it failed, and it ended up in the Dust Bowl. So some guy woke up one day after World War II, and he says, look, there's water underneath us. Let's bore holes in the ground, and let's bring this water up and irrigate all this ground. And they did, and they built the infrastructure on this groundwater. That's what I've been reporting to you. Now this Oglala aquifer is being pumped at the rate of 10 times faster, or 10 times more than it's being recovered, or that the aquifer can recover. That's the Achilles heel, because this thing's going to run out of water in the next 10 or 15 years, or 20 years. I know I'm not a prophet. I can't tell you exactly, but all these experts that are writing these books that I'm reporting to you are telling you that, and I told you that there's four or five reports, and I'm reporting now from the Kerr Center. You know, maybe they're lying to us, but I'm just pulling the information together and throwing it out there for you. So I got to doing some research on the surface water, and I took the driest place in the country. It's called Arizona. That's called the arid zone. If there's any place in the country drier than that, I don't know where it'd be. I guess Death Valley might be a little drier. But as a general rule, they call it the arid zone. I think at Arizona, New Mexico, and West Texas, and maybe, you know, the Southern California, Mojave Desert, they're probably about the driest places that you can find in the United States. And I did the arithmetic on it, and I think that there's enough rainfall over those regions for all of those people to live there on surface water and to live handily. And I'll tell you about that when we come back. I got to give you a reminder here if I can find my notes. Maybe I won't give you a reminder if I can't find the notes. Oh, here they are. About halfway through the program, I have to tell you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and that's because the FCC and our producers and sponsors and all the people that deal with us over here, they don't want anything to do with us. I mean, they want us to put a disclaimer in here that says that the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. Don't you brand us with those crazy ideas, Gordon. So I have to tell you that these ideas and these opinions and these reports do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. And if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, where do we get all these crazy ideas and reports, you can do that at our website. It's called georgegordon.org. It's easy enough, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct here at the law school. We'll talk to you live. And the number here is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And then we like to add to that, since the good people at the Kerr Center and the Executive Intelligence Review, is that what it is, EIR? Yeah, Executive Intelligence Review, published by www.larouchepub.com. thecursecenter.com, and the Curse Center are the good people who gave us the basic story that we're covering this week. And the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. I mean, we're not pulling your leg here at all. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications used on this program, and that's because we're not smart enough here on this program to come up with this information. We have to get it from people who do know something about these subjects that we report on. So we often endorse and recommend these books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. And so I recommend that you get a copy of this LaRouche report and a copy of the Curse Center report, and that you go to Google and take a look at groundwater and go to the USGS. And scientists say drought accelerating depletion of the Oglala Aquifer and so on, and research it out for yourself and check up and find out. That's the purpose for making these reports. But when we do that, we like to give credit to those people that have spent the time, effort, and energy to dig this out. Because honest to God, if you were waiting for me to dig it out, hell would freeze over first. Now, when these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate, because they might not want anything to do with us either. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here are religious, political, economic, sectarian, or racial or ethnic partisans. And they don't like us, and we want to point out that we don't necessarily agree with everything that Lyndon LaRouche says either. I don't know everything that Lyndon LaRouche says, but I want to point out that sometimes people will write me a letter and they'll say something like, "Oh my God, I can't believe that you got that information from that source, and don't you know they're a bunch of commie pinkos?" And, you know, hell, even the Pope once in a while comes up with some good information, doesn't he? So we like to give credit to those people that take their time, effort, and energy to search this out. Now let me go back here to where I broke in, and I said I did some arithmetic. Get your pencils and papers out here, boys and girls, because there's plenty of water out there. It's been misdirected, and I'm going to show you why. I'm like everybody else. I rely upon groundwater 100%. Well, I say 100%. It's actually not quite that, but for practical purposes, 100% of the water that we use here on this farm comes from groundwater, and I'm prepared to admit that that's a mistake, and we're going to make some changes here on this farm. It's a mistake because I thought that the groundwater was recharged by the rainwater. I thought that, you know, it's just a natural process. I went to school, and the public school teachers told me that it rains, and the water percolates and seeps down through the ground and recharges the groundwater, and that's where we get our groundwater, is from our wells. And that was a good idea. When the first guy drilled the first well, there was no problem. His neighbor saw how free and cheap the water was, so he drilled the well also. And then his neighbor saw how, what great results he was getting, and so they drilled wells, and they drilled wells. And finally, so many of us drilled so many wells and drew so much water out of the aquifer that now, today, in the year 2006, we are drawing water out of the Oglala Aquifer at the rate of 10 times more than it recharges every year. 10 times faster than it recharges. And we built cities like Wichita, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri, and Omaha, Nebraska, and Lincoln, Nebraska, and we built these cities, and Phoenix, Arizona, on top of these aquifers, and we drew the water out, and now we've got highways and freeways and big buildings and millions of people. In fact, I reported this. Half the people in the country get their water out of the ground. I'm one of those. And we're taking the water out faster than it's being recharged. Now, that's okay for today because there's still plenty of water down there. But there is coming a point in time when that water is going to run out. And when it runs out, there's going to be weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. There's going to be great sadness. So in order for us to avoid that, we should take action before that happens. It's kind of like having a bank account and you're drawing money out of your account faster than you're putting it in. Before it runs out and you go flat broke and go bankrupt, you should start taking evasive action about the time when you get down to the last 20% or 25%. Maybe we ought to start thinking about the future, and that's where I'm at today. I think we better start thinking about the future. Now, if you got your pens and papers out there, boys and girls, let me show you something. Arizona is a piece of real estate of approximately 114,000 square miles. Let's just round it off to 100,000. 100,000 square miles. That's a big piece of real estate. In the United States, there's a couple of states bigger than that. To give you a little perspective, Texas is 236,000 square miles, so Texas is about 2 1/3 times bigger than Arizona. Alaska is 500,000 square miles. Alaska is 5 times the size of Arizona. But the smallest state in the Union, Rhode Island, is about 1,000 square miles, so Arizona is about 100 times bigger. Get this, you people that live up there in New England, 100 times bigger than Rhode Island, our smallest state. So I gave you a little perspective over here. Now, Arizona has about 5 million people living in it. 5 million people. About half as many people as live in the New York metropolitan area. Last time I heard, somebody said there's about 10 or 11 million people living in the greater New York metropolitan area. That's not just New York City, but all around there, in little suburbs and so on. My God, you get more people crammed into New York City, for crying out loud, twice as many as you have in the whole state of Arizona. But Arizona's running out of water, and there's no water shortage in New York, and there's no projected water shortage in New York, because New York City gets its water from the surface water. I imagine there's a couple of wells up there, but primarily it comes from the mountains. You've got reservoirs up there. You're collecting the surface water in New York. Out in Phoenix, you're drawing it out of the ground and relying upon the Colorado River, which you're trying to divide up about 14 ways, and you're running out of water. Now, Arizona doesn't get very much rainfall, but some of it gets as little as 6 inches a year, and some of it gets about 14 to 16 inches. So I'm going to just take a number, 12 inches of rain, average, over the whole piece of real estate. And it may be a little high. If it's a little high, then we'll just take a percentage off of our final calculation. But I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised, you Arizonans. There's no shortage of water in Arizona. There's a lot of mismanagement of the water that you have in Arizona. But there's no shortage of it. Not yet. And that's because you don't have 30 million or 140 million people living on this piece of real estate like they have over in Bangladesh that I reported on earlier, or in China or India. Those guys have a bigger problem because they've got large populations. Down in Arizona, you've only got 5 million people. 5 million. And there's more than enough water. Listen to this. If there's 100,000 square miles of real estate and there's 640 acres of land in a square mile, then there's 640 acres times 100,000 square miles. Well, that's 64 million acres. So write that down. 64 million acres. Now, it rains on those 64 million acres about 12 inches a year. That's an arid zone. Some people say that Phoenix, I think I heard this number, that it rains 8 inches a year in Phoenix. Somebody said that it was around 10 inches in Tucson. So I'm going to round this off to 12 inches here. And that's because an acre foot is the amount of water 1 foot deep over 1 acre of land. Now, an acre has 43,560 square feet in it. So write that down. 43,560 square feet in an acre, 12 inches deep. That's called 1 acre foot, and it equals about 326,000 gallons of water. So write that down. 326,000 gallons. Ah. Now, over the whole state of Arizona, in theory, if you could collect all of the water that rains on your state, 12 inches on average, over the whole 100,000 square miles, you would have 64 million acre feet of water. Now, there's only 5 million people in the state, but we want more people to move in. So let's double our population to 10 million over the next 20 or 30 years. Okay? So let's plan for 10 million people in Arizona. That then leaves us with 6.4 acre feet per person in the state of Arizona. That's how much rainwater you're getting. Now you're getting shortchanged because here in Missouri where I live, we get 52 inches a year. Not quite rainforest, but almost. Not quite. They say you got a temperate rainforest when you get 60 inches. We got a lot of forest land here, and we're getting 50 inches a year in round numbers. Last year, we got 38 inches. We were 14 inches below normal here. Even at that, 38 inches is plenty. Hell, you people in Arizona, you know, you people would be in Fat City if you had 38 inches a year. We're sitting here in a drought, for crying out loud. 38 inches, oh my God, we're in drought conditions. I told that to my buddy out there near Nevada. And I forgot what Wayne said they get out there, I don't know, 6-8 inches a year. Just boggles your mind. Now, up in the mountains, they get a little snow, but down there where he's at, you know, he doesn't get very much rain. But he's got plenty of water. And I was amazed when I was out there in Nevada. He said, there's no shortage of water in Nevada. We got water everywhere. Just got to know where to go look for it. All right, now you people in Arizona, you've got 6.4 acre feet per person per year. Now just multiply 6.4 acre feet times 326,000 gallons, and that's 2 million gallons per person in your state. That's how much rain you're getting. Now it may be a little high, and if you're living in an area or you're living someplace and say, well, we only get two-thirds that amount. Okay, well, then cut it down by two-thirds. You only get 4 acre feet per person. No, still 1 million gallons. Now, how much water does a person use per year? Well, when I was a kid, they used to figure that a household in Eureka, California used 3,500 gallons of water a month. That's about 100 gallons a day, round numbers, 100 gallons a day. Today, we calculate in America, anyway, that we in our households use 200 gallons of water a day. 200 gallons, twice as much. But even at that, that's only 100,000 gallons. It's less than 100,000 gallons a year. Now, we use a lot of water, you people out in Topeka, Kansas, to water your lawns. Down in Arizona, they don't water their lawns. They have a little different program. They put native plants in their yards. They put desert cactuses and things out there that can live on 8 or 10 or 12 inches of rain a year. And so they don't plant lawns. You know, it's a wild new concept, but you people in Topeka might think about that instead of planting lawns over here and trying to act like you're living in New England or living out here in Iowa or Illinois and getting plenty of rain. Maybe you ought to just use natural landscaping and stop pumping out of that aquifer. So when that governor said we could stop pumping out of the aquifer, he wasn't whistling Dixie now. It's possible. Now, here on our farm, it rains. And just picture this. I've got a 40 up here. 40, that's 40 acres. On that 40, it rains 52 inches a year. Do you know where all that water goes? It goes right straight down to the lake. I don't collect. I don't save. I don't use 1 gallon out of that 52 inches a year that falls on that 40 acres. Isn't that a tragedy? That's what I'm starting to think. I rely on the groundwater. And I need 600 gallons of that groundwater a day to water my stock, to run my house, to run the farm. I need 600 gallons a day. It's kind of like a business. It's kind of like an industry. You're running a steel mill, and it requires so many thousands or millions of gallons a day. You're running a power plant. It requires so many millions of gallons a day. That's why they site these power plants on the Missouri River, because the power plant has to have millions of gallons of water a day to cool it. So they site it where there's plenty of water. Unfortunately, I'm guilty of not using the water that God gave us. I don't have any shortage of rain here. I'm drawing water out of the aquifer, and then I'm complaining about my well going dry. Well, that's because all my neighbors are drawing their water out of the aquifer also. And they're complaining because their water's going dry, or their wells are going dry. The wells are going dry because of a misallocation of funds and a misallocation of our water. So I'm going to make some changes here. I'm going to start putting in step ponds in the gullies. Now, I live in a mountainous region here, and I've got springs that come out of the ground naturally. And I'm going to capture that natural groundwater that runs down the creeks and runs into the lake, and I'm going to build step ponds. And I'm going to pump water from here to there, and I'm going to pump it out of those springs. All right? Now, there's another source of water that's called rainwater, which simply runs off the land. Now, the rainwater that soaks into the ground and grows grass, that's great stuff. But there's also rainwater that can be captured in ponds. And the old-timers used to do that here. They would build ponds in the gullies and then capture the water and let the cows drink the water out of the ponds. I capture my water out of the aquifer and I put it in water troughs or water tanks and let them drink out of the tanks. You know, maybe the old-timers were a little smarter than we are today. Now, I got a couple of books from Australia. Those Australians now are pretty smart people. They live in a pretty hostile environment. It's desert country down there, and they build big cisterns down there. It's called the cistern system. And people that live in dry countries like the Middle East capture the rainwater off of the roof. Let's think about this for a minute. I've got a roof here of 6,000 square feet. That 6,000 square foot roof, every time it rains, the water runs off of the roof, onto the ground, runs off the ground, into the gullies, down the gullies, into the creek, down the creek, into the lake. I don't capture any of that water. I don't use any of that water to flush my toilet, brush my teeth, wash my dishes. But why not? Why not? Now picture this. You're living in Tucson, Arizona. And let's say it rains 12 inches a year. And you've got a roof, and that roof is 2,000 square feet. Well, let's just take a look here. 2,000 square feet times 12 inches, assuming that it rained 12 inches down there. If it rains 8 inches, well, then we got to take two-thirds of that. But I'm going to round it off. You got 2,000 cubic feet of water. How much water is there in a cubic foot? And the answer is 7.5. So let's just multiply that times 7.5. Well, boys and girls, that's 150,000 gallons. 150,000 gallons. All right, let's think about that for a minute. You live on a lot 50 feet by 100 feet somewhere in Tucson, Arizona, in the arid zone, where it only rains 12 inches a year. And your 2,000 square foot roof on your house collects 150,000 gallons of water a year on your little plot of 50 by 100 feet. Well, let's divide that out. 150,000 and divide that by 365 days. That's 410 gallons a day on average. And if you're a modern American family, you only use 200 gallons a day. And I say only. When I was a kid, let me give you a little illustration here, boys and girls, and let's think about it in pragmatic terms. When I was a kid, you took a bath once a week. Once a week, you took a bath. We didn't think we were dirty in 1945. Today, I take a shower every day. In fact, I put a heater in. I put in one of these continuous hot water heaters so that I can stand and bask in my shower
for 15 or 20 minutes every day. I get up in the morning and I take a shower every day for 15 or 20 minutes. And my shower head is one of those water saver shower heads. I wouldn't want to waste water. And I think it puts out around 2 gallons a minute. I take a 15-minute shower at 2 gallons a minute. My God, I spend 30 gallons of water a day on myself just taking a shower, for crying out loud. I don't think most people in the world realize how wasteful we Americans are. And I'm not saying I'm particularly wasteful over here. If it's there, use it. If you've got it, flaunt it. But what I'm here to tell you, boys and girls, is that there's no shortage of water in Arizona. And if there's no shortage of water in Arizona, there's no shortage of water anywhere. There's just a misallocation of the way we use it. Now, in Australia, they collect that water off the roof, and they run it into a big concrete tank. Now, out in your backyard, if you'd build a cistern out there to hold 150,000 gallons of water, you don't need 150,000. You can have your whole year's supply in a 70,000-gallon tank and take long showers just like I do. So there's plenty of water, and if everybody in Tucson does that on their own piece of ground over there, there's plenty of water. Plenty of water. But that costs more money. And it's harder to do. It takes time, effort, and energy. And we don't want to do it because it's easier to poke a hole in the ground and draw it out of the aquifer. Now, as long as the water is in the aquifer, go ahead and draw it out. But be aware of this, that one of these days it's going to run out. And the infrastructure that you have built over the aquifer is dependent upon that water. And last year, my water started getting a little bit short. And last year, my water ran out, and my well went dry. And frankly, boys and girls, I wasn't prepared for it. And it caught me by surprise, but it woke me up, I'll tell you that. So I just thought I'd pass that along to you. There's no shortage of water. There's plenty everywhere. There's a misallocation, and the politicians aren't on top of it. The politicians, in this case, are followers, not leaders. And the big multinational corporations that are running these big agricultural feedlots and chicken operations and hog operations, you can rest assured that they're not going to be the first guys to plug their wells or to stop pumping water out of the aquifer. That isn't going to happen. They will pump on it until it runs dry. And one day there will be this great crisis. It'll kind of be like the great crisis of New Orleans. Everybody knew that at least 20 years ago when I first heard about it, that they were waiting for the big one to come. And when the big one came, nobody was prepared for it. That's the way human nature is. You know it's coming, but I'm not going to take the time to prepare for it. Now, there are a few people that prepare and they live a little better than those that don't. So I just thought I'd pass it along to you. So that maybe you could prepare. I'm going to prepare. I'm going to convert over from groundwater to surface water. It's what our forefathers did, and they got by quite nicely. We got off on the wrong track by using groundwater, and I'm going to stop doing it. All right, we're about out of time. I'm going to have to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, of course. Let me give you a reminder that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. And if you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. We are open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.